This is Four People with Bishop Rob Wright.
Hello, everyone. This is Bishop Wright, and this is Four People, our podcast, which gives us an opportunity to talk to people near and far about faith and life and God and leadership and redemption. Today, we have got a fantastic guest, someone who has got a story to tell, and it's a story ultimately of good news. In the Bible, the book of Genesis, we hear a story about Joseph. Joseph was wrongly accused, and Joseph languished in prison, but the story ends with prison didn't break Joseph, and God turned around that incarceration that was meant for evil. God made some kind of good out of it. Today, we have a real-life Joseph with us. Friends, meet my new friend, Lawrence Bell. Lawrence, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so glad that you're here. You were introduced to me some weeks ago by a friend, our mutual friend, Gregory Ellison, who is a professor at Emory and who teaches a wonderful curriculum called Fearless Dialogue. And he texted me and said, "Rob, I've got a phenomenal guy I just want you to meet." And so that's how you and I come to this podcast today. So Lawrence, tell us a little bit about your story.
Well, I guess I'll kind of start in the middle a little bit, which is the important part, or not necessarily the important part, but the part that kind of relates to the story of Joseph. At the age of 14 years old, I was incarcerated in the city of Camden, New Jersey for a crime that I actually didn't commit, but that's neither here nor there. But I was incarcerated for murder, armed robbery, kidnapping, aggravated sexual assault, along with a 22-year-old. I went to trial, and ultimately I was convicted for these crimes, despite the fact that there really was no evidence. And I was sentenced to a term of life plus 50 years with a 55-year parole disqualifier. So at 14 years old, I was told that—
Hold on just a second. You were how old?
14 years old.
14 years old. Please keep going.
As I was saying, I was sentenced to a term of life plus 50 years with a 55-year parole disqualifier, which meant that I wouldn't see parole until I wasn't even eligible for release until I was 70 years old. So I ended up going to prison, and ultimately I served 30 years in one day before I was resentenced on an illegal sentence motion, basically arguing that it was inherently wrong to throw children away, to make a determination at that young that my life was forfeit, that I was irredeemable, that there was nothing that could be done for me. And I was able to win this resentencing really because of the works that I had done while I was in prison. And I was resentenced to a term of 48 years with a 30-year parole disqualifier. And when I walked out of the, door June 28th, 2020, with no parole, no supervision. And I'm here now trying to make a difference in the world, to kind of prevent the things that have happened to me in my life from happening to other children.
So at 14 years old, are you in with adults? Are you in a juvenile facility? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I got arrested on June 27th, 1990. I went to the Camden County Youth House with the other children, but I was waived up to the adult courts in October of 1990. I had just turned 15 years old, and immediately upon my waiver to the adult court, I was sent to the Camden County Jail with the adults. I was the youngest person ever in Camden County Jail at the time. And that experience was a whole different chapter in subject matter itself. But I spent 3 months with children, and then the next 30 years and 30 years with adults. Like, it just, I never went to a juvenile prison.
Yeah. Now, prior to this terrible murder and your being found guilty or allegedly found guilty, what was life like for you? I mean, how did you get in that predicament to even be in a place where someone could even think that you might be guilty?
Well, that's the other part of my story that was overlooked by the court, that just wasn't taken into consideration by the court, and that is kind of the unknown part of this. So I'll start with I'm the youngest of five children, three brothers, one sister. I'm the only. My mother was Irish. My father was black, but I'm the only one of my mother's children that has a separate father. The rest of my brothers and sister, they're 100% Irish. I lost my father at 18 months old, around 18 months old. So I don't have a working memory of my father. And I ended up, ultimately, I lost my mother at 9 years old. My mother actually was killed by the man that she married, her husband, and died with her head in my lap at 9 years old. But prior to my mother's death, and I guess I can only speak now with the knowledge of hindsight, like looking back, I really understand what was going on. But because at the time it was normal to me, but I grew up in a very abusive household, and I'm talking about everything from what we would call torture today. Like it just would be unheard of. I've been locked in closets. I've been literally held in the corner while dogs were like nipping at my feet. I've had pets fed to vicious dogs. I've been starved. I've been beaten. My sister literally jumped out of a third floor attic window to escape abuse and broke her ankle. All of this at the hands of the man that ultimately killed my mother. Now, the most troubling thing about this for me, well, it's troubling altogether, but So I'm from Camden, New Jersey. Let me start there. So I'm from Camden, New Jersey, and I grew up in Camden, New Jersey at a time where Camden was the most violent city in America. It was a city that is 10 square miles, but for I think 4 years straight had the highest per capita murder rate in the country. And that's the era that I grew up in. So a lot of the things that we look at now as war zone, like for me was normal growing up. And then the abuse that was inside of my home, because I was so young, I didn't understand it to be abuse. I assumed that this was just what was happening in the world. Like this was normal. So, you know, we went through, my childhood was very, very different than most people's, what most people would expect. Cause I don't think it was that different from many people's.
Sadly, that's too true in too many places that you have youngsters trying to raise themselves and patch together some sort of upbringing. So you basically have lost your parents now. So how are you making it in the world up to 14?
Okay, so and I lost my mother at 9 years old. I was after my mother's death, I was placed into a group foster home. I was only in a group foster home for maybe 3 months, 2.5 months, I think, something like that, almost 3 months. And eventually a friend of my mother's who lived across the street from us came and got me. She came and apparently, I don't know all of the details. I never knew all the details because she passed away before we could have that conversation. But she came, apparently it was my mother's wishes that if something were to happen to her, that she would take care of me. Her name was Sarah Goins. Everybody called her Miss Peggy, our mama. She was arguably the best, most beautiful woman I've ever met in my life. Just a naturally good soul. In any event, she was older. She took me in and she tried her best. Like if I'm being 100% honest, she tried her best, but I think that at that point in my life, I was so emotionally damaged that I wasn't really able to accept the things, the love that she was trying to give me. I had started already developing this notion of everything and everyone that I love would eventually go away. So I kind of shut down. I suffered from selective mutism for like almost a year. I wouldn't speak to anyone except for my sister. I would whisper in my sister's ear. But in any event, she had a daughter who, because she's still alive, and I don't want, and the last thing I want to do is be disparaging to anyone. But she essentially just gave me to her daughter. Her daughter was only at the time 23 years old, but she was trying to get her daughter to settle down. And she figured that having the responsibility of caring for a 9-year-old, at this time a 10-year-old, would kind of settle her down. And it just didn't work out that way. This person became the person that had me out in the street selling drugs. She was very abusive. She was it just wasn't working for me. And by the time I was 11 years old, like I suffered through the abuses. Like I when my mother died, I developed a bedwetting problem. Like out of nowhere, I just started wetting the bed. And it was never viewed as anything more than being bad. So she used to do things like hang the sheet out on the porch and tell all the neighbors that I would wet the bed and things like that. And the abuse just became to the point it was repetitive of what I had went through earlier in my life. So I ran away. I skipped a part. At that point, I was taken to New York. That's where I was being raised at. And then I ran back to Camden because that's where I knew. So from the age of 11 to 14 years old, I was essentially a homeless kid. I was living on my own, and I was living in an abandoned house that we used to live in. And kind of just making my way the best that I could, selling drugs, running with older people. I wasn't living right, but I was living in the only way that I could at the time. Now, again, yeah. It's not an excuse. Right. It's not an excuse for the crimes that I've committed. It's not an excuse for what happened that night, even though I didn't do it. But it is something that a lot of times when we talk about criminal justice and criminal justice reform, that the court system sometimes assumes that these crimes that these children commit happens in a vacuum. Right. Like they just wake up, like a kid just wakes up and decides that they're going to go and commit a heinous act. And they're often remiss in really examining that child's life and figuring out what put him in that space.
Friends, this is For People. I'm Bishop Rob Wright, and we're with Lawrence Bell today. We'll be right back.
Hi, listeners. This is For People producer Easton Davis, thanking you for listening to part one of a two-part episode with special guest Lawrence Bell. To first-time listeners, we encourage you to subscribe. For all updates, follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Bishop Rob Wright. And now back to Four People.
We're on with Lawrence Bell today, a fantastic gentleman who's got a story of overcoming and redemption and grace. And so glad to welcome you back. Lawrence, you served 30 years in one day in jail and then walked out free. And you were accused of murder at 14 years old. Take us to that night where you were wrongly accused and where someone lost their life.
So it was June 27th, 1990. I'm 14 years old. I'm sitting on the porch of the abandoned house that I had been staying in at the time. It was in the heart of in the city of Camden. And a friend of mine's brother. So I had a friend, his name was David. He was my age. His brother, who would eventually become my co-defendant, had just come home from prison maybe like a month before. Anyway, he comes walking up to the porch and he tells me that, hey, listen, they just jumped David, his little brother. Let's go and find the guys that did it. And foolishly, I was like, okay. Like, I didn't know what we were going to do, where we were going to go, or how, but you jumped my friend. I was going to go with you.
Sure. Sure, and by jump he means that they were going to go that he had been
he was going to fisticuffs.
He'd been beat up by a number of people all at one time. Yeah, go ahead.
So when he came to get me, you know, I foolishly agreed, and we went walking around looking for these mystery people who were supposed to have jumped his brother. When we didn't find the people who jumped his brother, which I learned later that his brother never got jumped, mind you, but I didn't know that at the time. Yeah. So as we were heading back towards where I was staying at, he asked me if I was down to commit a robbery with him. If I'm being honest, I really didn't want to, but I kind of just, you know, I just didn't know how to say no. Like it was one of those things. He was 21 years old, going on 22 years old. And I'm at the time, I think that, again, and this is just with the benefit of hindsight, looking for someone or something to cling to. So I said, yeah, and I went with him. We walked to a place called the Rosedale Tavern in Camden, and he told me to wait at the parking lot. He walked around to the other side of the parking lot, and he approached the car. He bent his head down like he was talking in the window, and maybe 30 seconds later, he stands up and he waves me over. So I come over. He tells me to get in the car. I get in the car, and I get into the back seat, in the back passenger seat. He gets into the back seat behind the driver, And there's a woman in the car. So I look at him and he looks at me. He reaches over and hands me her purse and tells me to search her purse. And in the meantime, he's telling her to drive off. So I search her purse or whatever the case may be. And there's nothing in there. And I tell him that there's nothing in there. And then the woman's son sticks his head up from over the front seat. He was laying on the front seat. When I seen the little boy, I kind of freaked out like, yo, I want to leave. I want to leave. And he just was like, nah, we're good. We're good. We're good. So he started talking a little bit crazy. I don't want to be vulgar, but he started talking about what he wanted her to do for him sexually. And I just demanded I'm leaving. Like, I don't want to be here. But it was just kind of one of those things where the car was moving and I couldn't do anything. So eventually he had her pull into a lot, into a vacant lot, and he got out of the car with her, took her out of the car, and I stayed in the car with the baby. And I wanted to leave, but I didn't want to leave the baby. Like, I just didn't know what to do. So a few minutes later, I don't know how long, I really don't know how long it was, but he came back and told me that she had ran. So now I'm scared and I'm crying because now I'm like, we're going to get in trouble because she's going to go tell the police and we have her son and I don't know what to do. So he was like, just calm down, calm down, calm down. He drove the car off. He dropped me off. And he eventually took the baby back to the family, which I didn't know at the time, but apparently he knew the victim. He knew the victim's family because he was able to take the son back to the victim's family and say that he found him wandering in the street.
As
far as the crime goes, that was the extent of my involvement in the crime. And the next thing I know, the next morning, the police are searching the city of Camden looking for me. When I found out they were looking for me, they had contacted my sister and told my sister that they were looking for me. And I ended up going to the police station because I didn't know. Like, I went to the police station. And the next thing I know, I was told that I had raped and killed a woman and that I was being charged with, that my co-defendant had told them that the opposite of the roles, that he stayed in the car, that I took the woman out of the car and all of these things. So I got arrested. They eventually brought my foster mother in. And she signed a waiver saying that that she was read her Miranda rights, but she tried to stay in the room while I was being interrogated, but they kicked her out. And then they told her that I didn't want her to be there. So essentially I was left in a room at 14 years old with three seasoned homicide detectives and forced and bullied into making a confession to a crime that I didn't commit. I went to jail.
So only a public defender, is that what you had? Did the city of Camden supply you with some representation?
During my trial or during the interrogation process?
Well, yeah, I'm pretty clear that the interrogation was just you and the police officers, but all through the trial, just a public defender?
Yeah, so at first I had a public defender, his name was Charles Sandolis. And he was my attorney before. He wasn't a public defender. He was what they call a pool attorney, because the public defender's office is so overcrowded, they pull out to private attorneys to come in and take your case pro bono. But I had him for like 2.5 months until I got charged as an adult. Once I got charged as an adult, he was removed from my case, and I was given another pool attorney named Jay Blumberg, who. Yeah, I was just given another attorney.
Right. Okay. All right. And so at any time, did that legal representation argue for you not being guilty? Did they try to make a stand in that regard? Were they advising you to take a plea? I mean, how did it go? Did they talk about the interrogation and your age and all of that?
So from the very beginning, before I was even indicted for a charge for anything, the state offered me a plea of 30 years of 30 years served 30 years, which I wouldn't have taken because I still at that time had some faith in the system. Like, I didn't do it, and there's no way that I would be convicted of it. But the other part of it is that you're asking a 14-year-old to consider 30 years. Right. 30 years to a 14-year-old is a lifetime. At that age, they can't imagine 2 years. You tell them I have to wait till next Christmas for a bike and like their world ends. So I wasn't even able to really entertain any idea of a plea or anything like that. As far as challenging the admission of the statement, they attempted to challenge it. But what happened was, is at the time, because no one knew where my foster mother was, or my foster mother wasn't in the picture, the officer, his name is Harry Glimpser, was able to come into the courtroom and testify that she had given him permission to interrogate me outside of her presence, despite the fact that he didn't have anything signed to that effect or anything like that. And during this hearing, I took the stand and I essentially told the judge what happened. Like, listen, I was in there. They were threatening me. They told me that if I didn't tell them what really happened or tell them what they wanted to know, that I would do an additional 10 years, which is kind of interesting. If you think about, they're threatening a 14-year-old with 10 extra years, but so they understand how we view time, but, in any event, the judge made a ruling, and his exact words is, "I just find Detective Glimpser to be more credible. I think you're lying, Mr. Bell." Fast forward 10 years later, Detective Harry Glimpser is discredited by the New Jersey Supreme Court, where they literally said that verbatim, his methods of obtaining confessions were offensive to the protections of Miranda. So by this time, he had already been established as developing a pattern of abuses. But at the time, this hadn't yet happened. He hadn't yet been caught for it, but no one believed me when I said it. They did attempt to advance my innocence, but they just did a horrible job. If I'm being honest now, and this is not me speaking from a personal space of them doing a horrible job. This is me speaking as a person that understands the law, that I'm a state certified paralegal. I just graduated from Rutgers Law and all these things, but just from an evidence standpoint. So there was 11 pieces of physical evidence attached to the crime. Not a single piece of physical evidence attached me to the crime. Just one single strand of hair that they found on my co-defendant attached me to anything. They had no fingerprints, no footprints. At the time, DNA testing wasn't available. And unfortunately, the victim and I shared the same blood type. So when they did blood type testing on the semen, they said that they couldn't identify me as the source, but they couldn't rule me out as the source. They had, for instance, I told you that part of this thing is that when he got out of the car, he took the victim with him out of the car. Now, mind you, I'm 14 years old. I think I was wearing like a size 6.5 shoe. I'm 45 years old now. I only wear a size 9, 8.5, 9.
Okay.
In the ground was wet. It had rained previously, but they found at the scene foot impressions, sneaker impressions and foot impressions that the ground was wet enough for it to be 1.25 inches deep into the ground. So they took moldings of the footprints and it matched in size and then tread into my co-defendant and to the victim. So now but what they're saying is that we both got out of the car. So if we both got out of the car, where is the third set of footprints? They said that I drove the car, but they dusted the car inside and out, and they didn't find any fingerprints of mine in the car, on the car, around the car, anything like that. Just none of the my co-defendant had jumped across the front of the car. They found his footprints on the car. They literally all 11 pieces of evidence pointed to my co-defendant. Now again, fast forward to 2010, which is 20 years after the fact, and the New Jersey State Legislature comes out with a method by which people who have been convicted of certain crimes can petition the court for post-conviction DNA testing. I petitioned the court. I first wrote to the Innocence Project, to Barry Sheck, explained my situation to him and said, listen, I need your help. This was in 2009, but this is before they passed the legislation. So they sent me there's a questionnaire that you have to fill out, and then you have to send, all of your transcript and documented evidence to him. So I sent it all to him. And they sat for almost a year without doing anything. And then in 2010, they passed the legislation for this post-conviction DNA testing. So I sit down and I kind of study and learn it real quick. And I wrote a handwritten petition to the court asking for post-conviction DNA testing. and they granted it. I wrote to the Innocence Project and told them that I got granted it, and then they wrote me back and said they couldn't help me because I'd already been granted DNA testing. So that's a whole nother story. But the DNA testing.
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Well, let me stop you there because I think that you know what occurs to me, and I'm betting people are wondering is that, you know, you're 14, and now you're in adult jail, and then you've got this other part of the story where now you are leading yourself through a legal process. You are advocating for your own justice and another trial, et cetera. So tell us a little bit about what happens between 14 and you being now an adult and sounding pretty savvy and sophisticated in terms of your own sort of legal representation. I guess, Lawrence, what I want to say is, how did it all hold together for you? I mean, you know, a lot of people would be just done under by being wrongly accused and all of the trauma that you've experienced in your home life, all of the betrayal on behalf of lots of adults in your life. How are you making it? How does God enter into this thing? Who are the angels you met over these 30 years that have supported you? How do you get to here sounding so positive?
Well, I have to say that you know, we have these notions of prison, right? And it's important for me to say this because I think that at some point we have to try to reclaim some of this narrative. But I was by the time I went to trial and went to prison, not the county jail, to prison, I had just turned 17, and I was blessed in that I was placed around some older brothers that had their head on right in the midst of chaos. And I guess they seen something in me, or maybe they felt sorry for me being so young and being in that prison population. But, you know, they kind of steered me in the right direction. One of the brothers, his name is Russell Owen. Thank God he's coming home on July 6th after having served 33 years. He's now an ordained minister. He actually got his doctorate in divinity while he was in prison. But in any event, he was one of the guys that kind of he just introduced me to something different. Like, despite the fact that I was in prison in one of the most violent places in New Jersey, I started off in a young adult prison called Bordentown in Yarraville, which, you know, they classify, if you ever look it up, they call it gladiator schools. But he just kind of he really took an interest in a real concern with my life, and I think for the first time since I had lost my mother, I started understanding that someone actually cared about me. So instead of putting a basketball in my hand, he put books in my hands. He introduced me to classical music. He was one of the people that informed my life. Right, if that makes sense, right? And it wasn't just him. There was quite a few people. There was the pastor at Garden State Correctional Facility at Yarraville, where I was at. His name was Reverend Ray Dubois, but Dubois, as everyone else calls him. Older white gentleman, like jolly good guy, man. And despite the fact that I'm Muslim, he took me in. Like he really, like. I don't know. I think he just is, for whatever his reasons were, he always made sure that I was okay. Like I would go and sit and spend hours with him, just talking to him about my life. And he helped me deal with and confront things that were going on in my head as a result of my life, that things that I experienced in my life. That kind of, in a way that made me see that I was bigger than, right, that I didn't have to be. And this is one of the biggest things that I'll say is that these people that were in my life, they instilled in me this notion that I didn't have to be what everyone else said I was, right? That what the court said I was, what my situation said I was supposed to be, that I didn't have to fall into that, that I could choose to be better and do better. And because of the genuine love and that I felt from them, I took that advice. I really, really took that advice. I invested myself heavily in education and in self-improvement programming. And I just, and then the other part of it, if I'm being honest with you, Bishop Wright, is that I was stubborn, right? So when I got sentenced, the judge said some pretty horrible things to me. You know, he told me that I didn't deserve to breathe another free breath. He told me that I was irredeemable, that nothing good would ever come from me. And that it was, he actually told me that if he could have given me the death penalty, that he would have. And besides the fact that I didn't do it, it just was like, and you're in a position where you can't even respond. So it was just like, you know, I've always held that next to me and used that as kind of my motivation to, if I could do nothing else than to just turn my nose up at him.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that word, I would argue that word irredeemable is an affront to God. It offends God. Because again and again, the Bible tells us, the Quran tells us, right? Hebrew scripture tells us that God is busy about the business of redeeming, of making things new. And so while I understand people's temptation to use that term, especially over human beings, there are so many stories where things that looked irredeemable become exactly the perfect vessels for God's grace and God's good news.
I definitely agree. You know, it's and again, this is me talking in the present. You know, I'm one of the things that I have been determined to do since I've been home. It hasn't even been a year now since I've been home. This month, the 28th of this month makes a year. But
yeah,
since I've been home, I've been working diligently to try to get that language and the implications of that language removed from juvenile justice systems. And it's simply because I understand, having went through it, I understand that my argument is, and this is the argument that I make to everybody, is that, again, I didn't do it. I really didn't do it. And I have no reason to lie at this point. Like I'm home, I'm free. I don't have no reason to lie. But even if I did, so if you have a child that did commit the worst offense, is that singular offense that 1 minute, 2 minutes, that 30 seconds it takes to pull a trigger, is that the thing that is going to forever define that child? Does that determine who that child is going to be? In the context of our current criminal justice system, the answer to that is yes. And I often wonder how the people that make these decisions would feel if they were judged by the worst mistake they've ever made in their life becomes the defining moment of their life. If everything that happens after that is always viewed through that lens. And that's essentially what we do to these children, particularly disproportionately children of color, children from Black and brown communities, children who come from situations that warrant the most care.
Yeah,
they're given the least amount of care. And that's just problematic for me. And that is part and parcel to the reason why I wanted to do this podcast, because I really want, I think that at times certain segments of our society don't really know what's happening in these systems, right? And I think that if they really knew and understood what was happening, there would be outcry. It just wouldn't fly.
Right. Right. Well, that's part of the reason why you and I have the privilege of talking to one another and sharing our conversation, with our listeners and hopefully beyond. So I'm Bishop Rob Wright, and we're on with Lawrence Bell, and we'll be right back.
Hi, listeners, and thank you for listening to part one of a two-part story with special guest Lawrence Bell. Be sure to join us next week as we continue this powerful story of darkness turned redemption. Keep up with us on Instagram and Facebook at Bishop Rob Wright. Leave a review, share this story, and we'll be back with you next week.